Bring greetings to each one of you here this morning in Jesus' name. Trust that you've been blessed this morning and ask for the Spirit's continued guidance through this service. I too want to welcome all of you visitors. We're glad that you're here with us this morning. Thank you for choosing to be here with us. You may open your Bibles for a message to the book of 2 Kings, chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5. We'll read the whole chapter at this time. 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, "Would God my lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy." And one went in and told his lord, saying, "Thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, Go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "Now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman, my servant, to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy." And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me." And it was so, when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, "Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, "Go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean." But Naaman was wroth and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike his hand over the place and recover the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar rivers of Damascus better than all the waters in Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. And his servants came near and spake unto him and said, "My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldest thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith unto thee, 'Wash and be clean'?" Then went he down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." But he said, "As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And Naaman said, "Shall there not then, I pray thee, be given to thy servants 2 mules' burdens of earth? For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. In this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth upon my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing." And he said unto him, "Go in peace." So he departed from him a little way. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "Behold, my master hath spared Naaman this Syrian in not receiving at his hand that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him." So Gehazi followed after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from his chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master hath sent me, saying, 'Behold, even now there come to me from Mount Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets, Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. And Naaman said, be content, take 2 talents. And he urged him, and he bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of garments and laid them upon 2 of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand and bestowed them in the house and let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said unto him, whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, thy servant went whither. And he said unto him, when not mine heart with thee, when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper as white as snow. Very, very touching account. If you let your mind and feelings, emotions enter into it, there's a lot transpired here. Some very happy things and some very sad things. The title of this morning's message is simply Lessons from the Life of a Leper. Lessons from the Life of a Leper. Now, we're going to draw more lessons this morning than just from Naaman. In fact, I think we're going to look at all the people mentioned in this chapter, or most of them. I guess we won't draw any lessons from the mistress, Naaman's wife, and maybe one other person mentioned in here. But it's, I think all the, I believe all the people mentioned that had part in this account, we can learn something from, some more than others. Some make up a bigger part of the message than others. What can we learn from these characters? Well, the first one we're going to look at is Naaman. We're not going to look at them necessarily in the order that they come in the story, but more the prominent roles that they played. Start out with the ones that we see the most about and kind of work our way from there, perhaps. So what can we learn about Naaman? Well, the first verse introduces Naaman. And it says he was a captain of the host of the king of Syria. He was a great man with his master. He was honorable because the Lord had delivered the Israelites into Syria's hand by him. He was a mighty man of valor. He had 4 really good things going for him. He was a mighty man, and if it stopped there, you would think of him only in a positive way, right? But, and it mentions one small thing, it just says he was a leper. That really changes your whole feeling if you were Naaman, right? He was a great man, he was a strong man, but in spite of all of that, he had leprosy. The Lord had even used him in a great way, and we know that this doesn't make Naaman a sinful man, that he had leprosy. It doesn't, but we do know that leprosy was used as a type of sin because of the way it spread and the way it set them apart from the camp, and so on, that we think of it as a type of sin many times, even though we're not saying Naaman acquired the leprosy because he was sinful. I want us to understand that. But even though he was a great man, somehow he had contracted this horrible disease, and it was going to take his life, I would assume. I believe so. It was very serious anyway. Well, the lesson in that is very clear for us to see that the sin problem is universal. It doesn't matter whether you were brought up a slave, whether you were brought up middle class, or whether you were or are whatever, a dictator or a king or a ruler. It doesn't matter. If you have leprosy, you have leprosy, right? And that's really what you're concerned about, what you need to be concerned about. How do you think Naaman viewed his might and his valor and his good standing with his master? Do you think it changed at all when he became aware of the fact that he had leprosy? Well, of course it did. The very view of who he was and how he felt. Everything changed when he came to be aware of the problem that he had. So he was a great man, but he was a leper. Now, let's look at something else about Naaman. He, because of this disease that he had, he at least in part, in verse 5, humbled himself. Now, it doesn't really just say this outright, and it's even a little bit hard to know how the word got to the king here of Syria, because it mentions that this maid went and told her mistress, and then someone went in and told the king. So somewhere, where was Naaman in all of this? I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us. I would assume he knew of this conversation before the king did. I would assume that. But either way, it just seems like a natural thing for us to, if you had leprosy and you heard of a doctor somewhere, even in a foreign country, that could cure you, what would be the normal thing to do? What would be the obvious thing to do? Well, go ask for help, right? Go see if you could find healing. But this took a fair amount of humility from Naaman to go back, where? Go back to the land of Israel and look for a person that would be able to heal him of his leprosy, right? That took quite a bit of humility, more than what you get just reading over the story. Now, it almost seems like it wasn't even his decision. It seems like it was the king of Syria's, but certainly Naaman had a part in this, I'm sure. And I don't know, neither does this account tell us specifically whose gifts these were. Was this something that Naaman had? Was all this silver and these animals and everything he took, were those all Naaman's, or were they sent by the king of Syria? I don't know that, and I don't know that it necessarily matters, but it shows a little bit of the mindset that Naaman probably had as he went to be cured. He later on says what he expected to happen, right? He expected some great show of might, and he wanted to be prepared with more than enough to pay for this, right? I'm not asking for any favors from you Israelites, right? But I'll pay for anything that you might be able to do for me. And I would imagine that he brought these things along probably more for his own good than he did for the king of Israel, because that's where he was being sent to, right? He didn't know yet that he was being sent to Elisha necessarily. I would imagine they were for his own feelings and ego than they were to do someone else good. But he did partially humble himself here, though he didn't realize how low he was going to be called to go yet. Well, what happened next? We ignore Elisha's part in this for now, but what happened? He came first of all to the king of Israel, and we'll just jump over that for now. But he was sent to the door of Elisha, who was a humble man in humble dwellings, probably not where, well, certainly, I think we could conclude not where Elisha, or not where Naaman expected to be sent. And what happened when he received the instructions of what would save, what would save his life? What happened? He fell on his knees and gave thanks that he'd been given the answer to his sin problem, his leprosy problem, right? No. He became very angry. Why did he become angry? When Elisha calmly told him the answer, why did Naaman become angry? Think through this with me. Why did he become angry? What was the problem? Well, he didn't get what he expected, but what was at the root of that? Keep digging a little deeper. Why did Naaman become angry? Because he deserved more than this, right? Because he came looking for healing as a great man, as a captain of an army, as someone who stood in high esteem with his master rather than coming as a leper. And he thought surely the way to be cured for a man of his standing would be for this man to come and wave his hand over the spot, call some power down from heaven. Maybe he knew the story of Elijah calling power down, calling fire down from heaven. Maybe he made some connections. I don't know. He certainly heard stories, I'm sure, of powerful things that happened. And he expected this to be done for him. And I don't know why God chose to use Elisha this way, but certainly part of what was happening here is God wanted to teach Naaman, he wanted to make him aware of his true condition. God is simply no respecter of persons. It doesn't matter whether you come as a North American, grew up in middle class. It doesn't matter if you come as a Central American and grew up in a home that had almost nothing. It doesn't matter if you come from the Middle East and have more money than what we could ever dream of here, perhaps. I don't know. It doesn't matter where you come from, some of those countries. Okay, it doesn't matter where you come from. When you come to God, you come as a leper, as a sinner, right? If you're looking for answers to the leprosy problem, you come, you have to come. God only receives lepers. He doesn't receive captains of armies and so on. I hope you understand what I'm saying. He only accepts when people come to him in humility and realize their true condition. And when you come to God, few of us actually come to God realizing how desperate and how needy we are. Few of us actually come that way. When you get there, God has to work in your heart and show you who you are and how desperate you really need to be. And you can, all of us that have come to God and needed initially when we came for salvation, and later on when we came for help with sin problems and confessing sins that we've fallen into and all, we could tell stories. If you've dealt seriously with God, if you've been serious about your leprosy problem, about your sin problem, you could all tell stories of how God had to take you even lower to show you that I didn't realize yet just how sinful I was. God is no respecter of persons. We can gain that from this. And I'd like us to ask this question and answer it honestly this morning. What do I expect from God? Do I expect thunder and lightning experiences? That's what I'm calling them. Do I expect God to deal with me only in ways that suit who I think I am? And going back to the Sunday school lesson this morning, does God always owe me palm trees and fresh water and things that I like in my life? Well, we answered that in Sunday school, right? Of course not. And how quickly we can get, how quickly even a leper can get distracted away from the healing that he needs to the power that he wants to see and the greatness he wants to see. Certainly something we can learn there. Well, what did Naaman do? Let me just kind of recap here. He was a great man, but he was a leper. He humbled himself, at least in part, but when he realized he's going to have to go even lower, then he became angry with Elisha. What happened next? Well, he mentally processed what Elisha had told him, and then, you know the next step? He invented a better plan. Okay, if you can wash into Jordan and be clean, I know what I'll do. I'll go back to the rivers and in my country, and they're much better. Okay, and that will be an even better plan. Why? Can you identify with that at all? Inventing a better plan than what God has given us? I'll be honest with you this morning. I can relate to that. God's way was just, in the life of Naaman, God's way was just too simple and a little too lowly and embarrassing. Now, Naaman wouldn't have processed it that way. He was just saying, well, he did sort of process it that way, actually. That is too lowly. I've got a better way. Human reasoning is a natural response when God's commands are too humiliating for us to carry them out just the way they say. This can have to do with confession of sin. This can have to do with making restitution for sin. This can have to do with esteeming others better than ourselves. This can have to do with a whole myriad of areas of life where we look at it and we say, if that's what God wants, I have an even better way to put it into practice. And you'll never come up with a better way. It won't work. What would have happened? What would have happened if Naaman would have followed through with the plan that he had devised? Well, we don't know exactly what would have happened, but one thing I know wouldn't have happened is that he wouldn't have come out cured of his leprosy because it wasn't God's way. I don't know what God would have done if Naaman would have followed through his plans. So after he had invented a better plan, now we got to keep skipping parts of the story because we're going to get to them when we look at other people. But so we'll just kind of jump ahead. When he did go and dip and follow God's plan and dipped in the Jordan River seven times, what happened? Well, he was healed as he obeyed God. When he humbly accepted, when he humbled himself far enough to actually do this lowly thing, that was asked of him. Then he was healed as he obeyed. And nothing short of humble obedience will ever work. Okay, we already covered this. Not going and finding some other river, not demanding that our expectations be healed. No, nothing short of humble obedience will ever work, even if it's something lowlier than going and finding a muddy Jordan River to go dip yourself in. There was no other way for Naaman, and there's no other way for us than to accept the conditions that God puts forward. So it wouldn't have worked to go back and dip in either these, what was it, Abana and Farfar, or however they say those the names of those rivers. I don't know if I'm saying them right or not. Anyway, it wouldn't have worked to go back and dip in them. Neither would have it worked to go to the Jordan River and dip twice and say, well, that ain't working, and walk off. Of course not. Only by following God's ways completely and humbly did Naaman find healing. And neither did it have to make sense to Naaman. It doesn't make sense. There's no logical link between washing in a dirty river and being cured of a disease. It should only make it worse, right? Now, we're talking physically now. That doesn't make sense. And we stretch our minds and we want to understand what God has for us and why his blood cleanses us from sin and all. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's a good exercise to put your mind to. But you'll probably, no, I shouldn't say probably, you'll never come to a place in life where it just makes sense. No, there's always a mystery to how Jesus shed blood actually washes us clean and makes us clean from the sin problem. But we trust that, and we know that it does. We've experienced it in our own lives, and we've seen it happen to other people, and it's always a marvel how that works. Now, I don't know. This is a story. We're drawing some lessons from it that we can safely draw, I believe. But we don't know how Naaman ended up exactly. It would be interesting to know. He still came back and wanted to pay Elisha, and we're not going to go into that part of the story here under Naaman. And that wasn't wrong in itself to show that he was grateful, but he still came back and insisted on paying. And we're going to get to this part of the story here in just a few minutes, but I wonder if that might be part of the reason that Gehazi was punished so seriously. So just hold on to that thought. He did ask, he did say that there is no other God than the God of Israel, which obviously, it's where we need to come to. He did say there was no other God than that, but he said, I do need to go into the house of Rimmon when my master worships. He leans on my hand, and I'll have to kneel down with him. Pardon your servant when you do that. And so there was something sensitive definitely working in Naaman's life where he realized that this God that healed me, he's the only God that I dare worship. So there's hope there. I don't know where Naaman's life ended up exactly, but let's move on. Let's move to the next individual that we're going to take a look at, and that's the king of Israel. We don't know much about him in this account, but we do. There are some lessons we could learn from him. Verses 5 through 7 deal with the king of Israel, who was Jehoram. You remember Jehoram, the son of Ahab? That's who was king in Israel at this time, the way I understand. Jehoram, it says, when it introduces him, was he a good king or a bad king? It says he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father Ahab, I believe is how it says it. Looked those verses up yesterday. He didn't serve God, but he didn't go to the extent of evil that Ahab did. Anyway, so he was not a God-fearing man, not a God-fearing king. And the king of Syria sends Naaman to him to cure him of his leprosy. I don't know exactly why the king of Syria sent him to the king of Israel. I guess there was probably no other way of looking up this prophet that could heal Naaman. And certainly if there was a man like that in Israel who could heal leprosy, we know it's by God's power, but I'm just speaking from a human viewpoint, Surely the king would know where to find him. I don't know what all was behind that exactly, but that's what they did. And he came to Jehoram, king, the king, and what did the king do? He rent his clothes and he said, "This man just wants to pick a quarrel with me. He wants war," which was probably a justified response, humanly speaking. I would imagine that could have easily been a way of picking a quarrel in those days. But this is what the king of Israel did. Instead of coming before the Lord, he took Naaman's problems on his own shoulders. He was a leader here, and so when this man came, there is a sense in which he was responsible for this. He was the king of Israel, but there's also an aspect where he should have looked further than just himself. And just because he couldn't personally cure this man of leprosy, he had a responsibility. He should have known that there was a prophet of God who could tend to something like this, and maybe God would use him in this situation. But he didn't. He didn't look any further than himself. He took Naaman's problems on his own shoulders. And I want us to learn from the king of Jehoram that no matter where God has called you, whether it's at home as a father or a mother or in the schoolroom or in the church or wherever it is, the work is not ours. No matter where we lead, we must look outside of ourselves for problems that arise. When you have a leper coming to you, and leprosy is a type of sin, especially so, we must look outside of ourselves for answers. We don't have the resources in ourselves, no matter who we are, no matter if we're the one supposed to be leading out here or not. Jehoram's focus was on himself and on what he had to lose. Okay, that was his focus. Whoa, what's going on here? The king of Syria just wants to come and pick a quarrel with me. It wasn't on, look at this leprous man, how could we help him? Neither was his focus on God and what is God trying to do in this situation. It was all about me, Jehoram, and what's going to happen to me. Now, that's a very natural response, I understand, but it was a wrong response. All right, so the next sub-point I had here is that he believed others were just out to get him, and we already talked about that. He instantly, the first thing that happened is he went into self-protection mode when Naaman came. And the other sub-point, which I've already trampled on a little bit, is that we must be willing to let others help. Just in preparing this message, I thought of two examples that I heard about recently and another one I experienced recently, where people who were in leadership willingly and readily let people help. Now, they're both examples of what happened in church life, and I don't want you to get distracted by that and think I'm just preaching to just, if you're a church leader this morning. The example goes broader than that. Here a while ago, this is an example I just heard about, there was someone lost a family member, a child, and the bishop in that district was there visiting with them and trying to comfort them. And while he was there, another family came who had lost their child in a very similar way as what this family did. And he said he realized at that moment it was time for him to fade out. There was someone else there who could minister to this family right now in a way that he couldn't, even though it's a bishop's responsibility to go around and help encourage people, right? He was humble enough to accept that it's time to let someone else minister to this situation right now. He looked outside of himself for answers. Not so terribly long ago, I'll be vague about this situation, but I called a deacon somewhere to ask about a situation that involved me and wondered about the situation, wondered how we could best help or how we could find our way through this. And in the conversation, he said, I don't want to shirk my duty here. He said, but there's another family lives just down the road that actually understands that situation a lot better than I do, even though I want to be involved. They click better. They understand each other better. Why don't you tell him I told you to call him so he doesn't feel like he's trampling over my responsibility and ask his opinion? Well, that deacon knew something, even though it involved personal relationships. He realized there's other people can speak into this situation. He didn't want to shirk his duty, but he looked outside and let others be involved that could more readily and easily help in this situation. Now, take your mind away from church and think of at home. You're called to be a father. You're called to be a mother. You're called to be Sunday school superintendent at church. You're called to be wherever God's called you to lead. Don't be lazy and don't expect other people to do your job. That's not what I'm saying. But realize that there's answers outside of you also and outside of your realm of responsibility. And let other people help you. And when proverbially God sends lepers to your door, don't freak out. That sounds very... But don't get all flustered like Jehoram did, but let others be involved. Other people have advice on how to raise your family and how to... Can't listen to everybody, but let other people be involved in this work. And we'll see this also as we go on in Elisha. So let's go on to Elisha. What did he do? Naaman comes to the door and knocks. Naaman didn't even go to the door. Did you catch that? Did I say Naaman didn't even go to the door? Is that what I said? Elisha didn't even go to the door. Is what I meant to say, okay? Naaman went and knocked on the door. Elisha didn't even go to the door. Oh, I lost my spot. I got into chapter 6 accidentally. Let me get back here. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee." So on. You can see in Elisha's response. Now, he may have just been trying to make a point here. I don't know. He was following God's direction, I'm sure. But for one thing's clear is that in Elisha's mind, it wasn't about him, right? It wasn't about getting any credit. Number one, he didn't even go to the door. He just told his servant, just go tell him what to do. Tell him I said this. And then he wouldn't accept payment for it, right? And so you can see by Elisha's response that this was not about Elisha, for sure. He sent a messenger out instead of going out himself. He wasn't looking for credit. And I don't know if it's worth the time to make a point on that, is it? Because none of us ever minds when someone else gets the credit for something that we've strove hard to do, do we? Oh, my. It can be something as simple as mowing the yard, right? Somebody thanks somebody else for it, and it just, boy, it gets me right in here, doesn't it? Elisha wasn't looking for any credit in this situation. He showed no partiality. His response was the same, whether it was a great captain of an army that came to his door, or whether it was a lowly person of Israel, or Samaria, or it didn't matter. It didn't matter, right? He showed no partiality, and that is something that we're hitting a lot of points quickly here, but I want us just to think about also in our witnessing. We're taking lessons and we're pulling them over in a different context, but in our witnessing to others, in our helping, in our ministering to others, do our tactics change or don't they? Is everyone a leper before God or aren't they? And I know we need to minister to people in a way that's going to be effective and the way they want to be ministered to an extent. But as people come through these doors at the back of our auditorium, does the way we treat them have anything to do with the social level that our community puts them? Or is it all the same when it comes to dealing with people's souls? There's certainly a level where they need to all be the same, where there's certainly no partiality. And then Elisha also accepted no payment. It was true servanthood. I would imagine God directed him on this. I would assume so. But in stark contrast to Gehazi, Elisha accepted no payment. So the fourth person that we'll look at quickly here is Naaman's maid. We know very, very little bit about her, but she spoke in faith. Verse 3, she simply said, "Would God, my Lord, were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy." You see the simple statement that she made? In her mind, it doesn't look like there was a question. There's a man back in Samaria, he would heal him. With simple faith. She didn't even look at the improbability of it. There's something that happens almost exclusively in children. They'll make statements that they don't even think about how much it would take, how much the improbable. But if my daddy were here, you know, this is what he would do. Well, you know, you can think of all kinds of things that children, and they believe it. Well, this wasn't that necessarily, but this maid said, if he were here, he would heal him. And it was a simple faith, and not grudgingly either. She didn't speak grudgingly. She spoke in faith, and she just spoke the truth in simple faith. And you know that we are called to be children, as little children, in Matthew 18. And that might go further than just this, but it certainly includes a simple faith that God can heal and that God will heal. Obviously, people have a part in this, but the faith of a child that God will heal, especially thinking of the sin problem. Now, let's look at Naaman's servants just a little bit. We don't know much about them, but we do know something striking. When your master is angry, when he's furious, and when he's got his face set on going home and putting a better plan into action, when he's just been insulted, what's the most natural thing to do? Go and speak reason to him? Against reason? No. It's to be quiet and say, well, it's up to him. Stupid, but we'll go with him. He might as well. He should at least try it. But no. They cared. Naaman's servants cared about Naaman enough. They genuinely cared to go and approach him about the decisions that he was making. They might possibly be the lowliest people that we're reading about in this account. Perhaps the maid or perhaps Gehazi. I don't know where they would have been socially. But anyway, his servants took it upon themselves. They cared enough to go and risk their position, and I would assume probably risk their life, to go speak what they did to him. I'm sure they spoke it in a gentle way, but what they said could have got them in serious trouble. I'm convinced of that. And they treated him respectfully. They didn't go around talking behind his back or whatever. On the way back, I imagine there was probably, just letting my imagination run, I imagine there was probably a little bit of conversation between them. What can we do about this? Shouldn't we at least try it? Should we talk to him? Why don't you? No, I'm not going to. He likes you better than he likes me. Can't you just imagine how that went? But finally, somebody was willing to speak up and say, Naaman, if he would ask you to do something really great, and I think what they meant there, something really tough to do to prove who you are. If he would have said, go out and bring me 100 skulls or whatever, you know, go, something really tough and valiant to do, you would have done it. You would have done it. Now, why not do something so simple like this and just see if it works? What do you have to lose, Naaman, is really what they were saying. And the fact of the matter is that Naaman, at the end of this chapter, at the end of this story, he owed them his life, didn't he? Along with some others, but he owed them his life because they were willing to speak to him. They genuinely cared enough to put their own selves in harm's way for someone they didn't really need to care that deeply about. But they did, and that's a lesson for us also. All right, the last person that we need to look at, and the saddest part of this story, at the close of the story, it's really, really sad, is Gehazi. He allowed his reasoning to be warped by his covetousness. From verse 20. I don't know what all was going on here, but several things. You see Elisha's gentle, humble way of working with Naaman. And then it says, but Gehazi. There was a difference here. He said, behold, my master hath spared Naaman this Syrian, and not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. I don't know if it was so much the greed that I want that silver and I want those clothing. Because what was he going to do with those changes of clothing? It reminds me of Achan a little bit. But maybe he could have. I don't know how outstanding they were. whether he could have ever worn them in Elisha's presence or not. It doesn't really matter because people that are deceiving don't think straight. They don't think about the outcome of what they're about to do. But I don't know if it was that motivated him so much that, like, I want that stuff for myself, or if it was the feeling of a little bit of being taken advantage of. That man had all that stuff. He got healed from his leprosy. He should be happy to leave all that stuff here. That's not right. Elisha didn't treat him rightly. He should have to pay a little bit. Like, we should be advantaged in this situation. I imagine it was as much that feeling as anything. That's what I'm interjecting some of my own feelings into this story. But I can imagine that was. And this side over here looks like they know what I'm talking about, maybe a little bit more than this side, because we tend to be this way. But it's only right. I mean, they should have to pay. They should not be taking advantage of us in any way, shape, or form, right? And well, we know. So he allowed his reasoning to be warped by his covetousness or by his sense of justice, maybe we could say. And then he went from there quite naturally as a... whatever, just quite naturally, he went and he lied and deceived to gain those purposes. He went after, I don't know if he thought through this story before he got to Naaman. It almost doesn't seem like he did. It really seems like he went after Naaman just intent on getting those things. And when he got there, he thought, oh yeah, there were the two prophets that came, sons of the prophets came, and we need some of this stuff. And I wonder what happened in his heart when he asked for one talent of silver, right? Is that what he said? Two young men, the sons of the prophets, give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments. And I wonder what happened in Naaman's heart if he wasn't a little bit ashamed when Naaman said, oh my, take two talents. By all means, take two. And he urged him. He should have been ashamed. I imagine he probably felt a little bit timid about that. But he lied and he deceived. And then, of course, you know what comes next. He attempted to cover up what he was doing. And he came back, and I don't know how he thought this was going to work either. He came back, and when he got to the house, he hid the things, and he went in and stood before Elisha. And Elisha said, where did you go, Gehazi? And Gehazi acted like a small child. When you ask them, what were you doing? What's the common response if there's nothing? Okay, and that will inspire doubt in any parent's heart, right? Because you weren't doing nothing. And that's what happened to Gehazi. Where'd you go, Gehazi? I didn't go anywhere. There was nothing to it just he had to lie and cover up and pretend that this didn't happen. And then the sad part is that Elisha says, because you went after Naaman. Okay, so he deceived. He became covetous, he lied, he deceived, and he attempted to cover up. That's bad enough in itself. By all means, that's bad enough in itself. And maybe that's all that Gehazi was being judged for here, but there was something else that happened too. In the greater scheme of things, remember how Naaman wanted to pay for his healing? Remember how Naaman insisted he turned back and he came back with this stuff and wanted to leave it? And Elisha told him, no, it's not a time to be receiving payments. He had taken Naaman as low as God wanted him to go. And then, supposedly, he sent his servant after him because he couldn't provide for the sons of the prophets that came through. You see what was going on here? I think there was something else God was being... was very concerned about that was happening here. All in this jumble, he was allowing Naaman to find some self-sufficiency here in his healing. Anyway, you know the story. We read it this morning. He went out from Elisha. Elisha told him, because you did this, you are going to be a leper in your house forever. And he acquired Naaman's leprosy. What can we learn from that? I'm getting these names so mixed up. There's so many names here this morning. Gehazi saw Naaman. And you know how he saw Naaman? He didn't see him as a leper. He saw him as a great man. He saw him as a captain of the army. He saw him, and he coveted what he had. You got that? He coveted what he had, and he forgot about the leprosy, so to speak. And because he went after Naaman, because he saw what Naaman had and he wanted it, what was the end result? He became the leper, right? Can you make the connection? Isn't that exactly what happens when we get infatuated with this world? And we see what they have and we forget about the sin problem? And we go after them to get a little bit of what they have and forget about the sin problem? What happens? You acquire the very leprosy of the world by being friends with the world. So God help us. God help us to be humble people. God help us to be discerning, to not be covetous, to not be like Gehazi, not be like the king of Israel, but to be humble like Elisha and be lowly like Naaman was. Let's kneel for a word of prayer. Dear righteous Heavenly Father, we bow before you just now. Thank you for your presence here with us this morning. Thank you for your answers to the sin problem, to the so many times we get in the way, and your requirements are so clear and so lowly that sometimes we have a hard time reconciling it with what we expect and what we thought that you were going to want of us. Help us, Lord. Help us to be always be humble and loving you. And help us not to be intrigued by this world and by the greatness and the glamour that we see in this world, but help us to have our eyes fixed on you and on your remedy for sin, the blood of Jesus. May we live humbly and peaceably with others and always loving you most of all. We ask according to your will in Jesus' name. Amen.